podcasts. Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
For thousands of years, people have had dogs as pets, and more recently as service animals for people with disabilities. And for thousands of years, many people have had a hard time training them. But far more recently emerging is a cottage industry of dog trainers, not just for service dogs, but for garden variety, oh, I guess I should say home variety doggies. To discuss what it's really like to be a dog trainer and if and how it's a viable career today, when at least in the Bay Area, it seems like there's a dog trainer under every rock, a longtime San Francisco dog trainer, whose website is poochcoach.com. Beverly Ulbrich, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Now, it seems that now calling dog trainers animal behaviorists, is that just a way to make dog trainers seem more highfalutin so they can charge more?
No. What's happening there is that there are dog trainers and then there's dog behaviorists. It's actually, they are two different things. Dog training is sitting a dog, you know, teaching a dog commands, sit, down, come, stay. Once we get into behaviors, you actually have to understand aggression, fear, what causes the problems. You have to be able to get underneath the dog psychology and even the human psychology to solve problems.
So in other words, the behaviors are going to deal with an aggressive dog that they don't want to send to be euthanized, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Right? Or a dog that's ripping up the house or isn't getting potty trained even. All those kinds of problems.
So let me try to understand it. So let's say I had a dog who was, and I speak from personal experience, I had a doggie who did indeed chew up on everything. What does an animal behaviorist do? You're a dog trainer or you're an animal behaviorist? You're both? What are
I'm
you?
I'm both. I've been a dog trainer since I was like 5 years old, and I've been a behaviorist since an adult.
Okay. And so let's say you've got my little Einstein, my sweet doggie, but he's sweet, but he just loves, and he's not a puppy. Let's say he's one. He's not like 3 months and he's teething. And he's just has a thing about chewing up everything from slippers to sofas. Walk me through the key steps of what you would do to break him of said habit.
Well, first and foremost, it's I don't break the habit. I teach the owner how to break the dog's habit.
And what would you tell me?
So what I do is I find out what the dog's lifestyle is like that might be causing these problems. And 90% of the time, it's lack of exercise.
Ah.
If people are not exercising their dogs enough or properly, then they get all this pent-up energy, just like I always say, it's just like 4 or 5-year-old kids. They get pent-up energy that they don't know what to do with, and they're going to make some really stupid decisions. But if you tire them out and give them jobs like you do with, a kid, you know, color here for this and then watch this and do this and then we'll go to the park, right? Do the same thing with the dog. Give them jobs, keep them busy, they stay out of trouble.
Now, of course, you know, it's going to depend on the age and the breed and the size of the dog, but let's just take my little doggy Einstein, who's 20 pounds, part terrier, part poodle, and let's say he was somewhere between 1 and 4 years old. What is the amount of exercise that such a dog normally needs?
I usually say about an hour on leash if possible, and then everything else is icing on the cake. So another half hour playing at the dog park or chasing a frisbee or whatever the dog likes is okay.
That's really a big, you know, people say when you adopt a dog, it's like having a baby that doesn't grow up. You've got to really make a major commitment to it.
Exactly. I say it's basically a 4 or 5-year-old kid. They can learn, for instance, not to cross the street without permission, but they can't learn to look both ways before they cross. That's a 6 and 7-year-old.
Right. So is it in some sense a little bit unfair to doggies, for apartment dwellers who've got to, you know, in the traffic today, somebody has a 9-to-5 job, has got to leave at 7:30 in the morning typically and doesn't get back till 6:30, so 11 hours. Poor doggies in an apartment. Is that cruel and unusual punishment, both for exercise and peeing and pooping purposes?
For sure, but that's hence we have dog walkers and doggy daycare. They're okay. Huge businesses now in San Francisco.
So, but in other words, for somebody to not hire somebody to come in at least once or twice during the day, is that truly unfair to the doggie?
Yes.
Okay. Just that's what I want to know. Okay. Now, you have a looked at all your Yelp reviews, and some people call you the goddess, but there are some who kind of give you a hard time because you're no-nonsense, and that's gotten you in trouble. With some clients. Tell me about that.
Yeah, the deal is with my business, what's hard about it is unless you have a brand new puppy or a brand new rescue, if you've had a dog for, let's say, even 6 months, most of the problems are because of you. And so I have to tell people that. And I try to tell them the nicest way possible, but many people don't want to hear that they're at fault for not walking their dog, or they've allowed their dog to beg or get into some bad habits by the way they haven't trained them, or even have trained them to be bad. And they don't want to take that ownership, and they don't want to do the work to fix it. And or so that's when people get mad at me, because they want a simple solution that I just can't give them.
I'm interested in the wording. You know, it's always a delicate balance when you want to give feedback gently enough so they don't blow you off, but firm enough so that they take it seriously. Let's role play. Let's say I am the owner of a doggy who has not gotten enough exercise, or I'm saying he's still peeing and pooping in the house, you know, on a semi-regular basis. I'm the person, what would you say to me?
Well, those are kind of two different things, the peeing and pooping versus exercise. So exercise is a good example, though, because I just actually had to basically fire a client yesterday because she's older, and she said she can't walk her dog. It's a puppy that's really energetic, more than three blocks. And I said, then I can't fix the problem of the dog pulling on the leash and trying to attack other dogs on the walk. You've got to get that dog out there much more. And she doesn't have the money to pay for a walker. So in cases of that, I even have to pull out, because it's like I can't do anything. But otherwise, I did help her brainstorm at first about go on next door, go on Craigslist, you know, advertise it. You're older and just need somebody to help you walk your
I want to hear the wording, though. Let's say I wasn't older. Let's say I'm a middle-aged person, say, and you've got to give me the bad news that it's my fault that I'm not getting exercise. How would you word it?
Well, yeah, I just say the dog needs more exercise, and I go over what kind of exercise the dog needs, why they need it, and all that. I even, you know, I have a whole pitch to try to help convince them so they feel like they can take it on.
Okay. You were on a show. Was it a TV show or a radio show called Mythbusters?
Mythbusters was a long-running TV show.
TV show. Okay. And what's a myth about dog training?
The one myth I busted there was you can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Ah.
So we took 2 9-year-old rescues that didn't know anything. And within 2 weeks, myself and another dog trainer, one worked with Adam and one worked with, now I forget the other guy's name. So sorry. but we worked with them, and we had them, sit, shake, I think, stay, and walk on a leash. And within 2 weeks, they both could do it.
What? Within 2 weeks?
Yeah. And that's only part time, obviously. These guys were running their show, too.
Yeah, but you're a pro. So, but what would normally, let's say I adopted a dog who was, say, 7. I like little doggies. So let's just say a dog who has a life expectancy of 15, but I adopted him when he was a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old, and he hasn't been well trained. How long would it take normally, if you coached me, for him to sit, stay, come, you know?
That 2 weeks was them doing it. I had to train Adam to do it. I couldn't do the training.
Right.
I showed him what to do, and he did it. So I had, like, my puppy, I got her at 8 weeks, within 3 days, she knew sit down, stay, and come, and I could even do it outdoors.
So, you know, many people, like me, I'm a do-it-yourselfer kind of guy. So I've had dogs my whole life, but if I didn't, my way would be to watch some YouTube videos and just, you know, I'm not a compulsive person, so it would be basically just sit, stay, and come, and the rest of it, you know, and of course, housebreaking. And am I foolish to think that in this day and age, maybe reading a few Google articles and watch a few YouTube videos and I'm done? Or should I really be hiring somebody like you, truthfully?
Truthfully, it really depends on, again, your personality and your needs. Some people want a dog, for instance, that they can have off-leash and really trust, and that usually people aren't good enough naturally as dog trainers to do that, and they need help. Mm. And, of course, if there's a behavior problem, it's just like having a kid with a behavior problem. Some people, you know, some parents can figure it out, and sometimes you need a therapist's help to come and see it from a different standpoint. Like, half of the time I tell people things, they say, oh, my God, that makes so much sense. Why didn't I think of it? That's really comes down to.
Now, I want to see if I'm being ignorant here. So if I were trying to teach my dog to be more, and I'm really crappy at this, my dog is not good at coming off the leash, coming to me. But if I was a good boy chick, what I would do is I would have a 20-foot leash, and I would, you know, slowly increase the distance between where he was and I am, and have my little Charlies, my little Trader Joe's treats, and, you know, and keep rewarding him until we got to the 20-foot mark, and then take him off the leash and do it. Is there any more complicated than that?
Not necessarily to start, but the problem becomes when you take him to the dog park and you don't have the leash on him and there's other dogs. Like, will he come if he wants to play with another dog? Or will he come if he sees a squirrel run by or whatever?
Right, exactly.
So that's when it becomes harder. So what I always say is you want to proof the dog. And the way I look at it is it's grammar school to teach a dog in your house to listen to you. And then middle school, once you have lower end distractions, by the time you have outdoor distractions, it's high school. And then you can have, like my dog, I consider a PhD. She can be off leash anywhere. She wouldn't chase a squirrel across the street. She actually listens to my command no matter what. And so you have a big range there.
So is there more than what I was saying is, like I said, 20-foot, you know, when there's minimal distractions, but then let's say just little by little extending it so that there are, you know, the squirrels and the dog parks or whatever. Isn't it the same basic technique, just continuing to make it a little more challenging all the time with little food rewards and praise rewards?
Yeah, depending. Again, it depends on, like, some dogs have a very strong prey drive and it's very hard for them to ignore birds nearby, and other dogs don't even notice the birds. So with dogs that have problems with birds, you really have to work on that as a specific problem and try to get them to know not to chase them. So I have videos even out that show me saying no birdie to my dog where she walks by them and get the birds and she chases them. I have her voice controlled on that. But if you don't have that and the dog has high prey drive, it can be really hard to keep their attention on you.
How do you recruit a bird to be in place during the time of training?
You just go places where you know they hang out. There's pigeons everywhere in the city.
You're right here too. Yeah, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I am talking with Beverly Ulbricht. She is a highly experienced San Francisco dog trainer and does some other cool things, which I'll talk about in a minute. I think what I'm going to do is give out the phone number. If you've got a question about what it's really like to be a dog trainer, this is the time to call the phone number here at KALW and Work with Marty Nemko, which is this show, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. What's another myth about dog training?
At the top of my head, let me think. I guess that, I know a good one, is that a lot of people think that the way their dog is just the way they are. So again, example, what I mean is, my dog doesn't like men. My dog doesn't like skateboards. My dog doesn't like children. So then they just avoid those things. It's never that your dog has chosen for some reason not to like something. It's that they haven't been accustomed to it. They didn't get socialized and they didn't learn what it was. And so they became fearful and they're therefore aggressive. So they either want to run away or attack whatever it is. But it has nothing to do with their preference for a certain type of person or object. It has to do with the socialization, and you can retrain that and get them to quote unquote like it with hardly any problem usually.
During, you know, we always do a pre-interview where I talk to the guest in advance to find out what's interesting things we could talk about. And you told me that something that was surprising was how little you actually end up as a dog walker, end up working with dogs or even people. You're having to spend a hell of a lot of time on marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, one thing people don't realize with dog training is, like any business, it's a business, so you have to do marketing and sales and bookkeeping and all that stuff. But you also have to constantly look for new clients. If you do your job right, you shouldn't get repeat customers. So unlike a dog walker or a dog sitter or even a groomer, you get the same dogs back over and over again, mm-hmm. so you get your customer base and you're kind of good for a while. We have to serve our customer base and always look for new business. So it's really just a lot of that work and very little time, like I was saying to you, that you actually get to sit sit with the dog and work with the dog. And I'm training people, so right. I don't touch the dog much anyway.
What's the approach to marketing that has worked best for you?
I think still with online, I was on the internet way before anybody else because I did internet marketing as a VP of marketing before.
Poochcoach.com, by the way, is
yes.
the website. Okay.
So I used my website, and then even Google Ads and things like that are usually the best thing. And even just SEO, meaning people just naturally find you by searching for a dog trainer in San Francisco. I come up very high. Because here's the other thing. Word of mouth is usually really good, and it can be. If somebody has a troubled dog and asks a vet, please give me help, they'll give out my name. But what doesn't happen is a dog sitter, for instance, doesn't say to their client, you have a bad dog, you should hire a dog trainer, because mm-hmm. that's what they hear. It doesn't matter what else you say. You could say she could, you know, benefit from a little more training, but they hear you have a bad dog. So people don't want to tell people to hire a dog trainer. So it's hard to get references that way.
How about previous clients, you know, getting referral. Well,
yeah, that does help a lot. What happens there a lot is somebody sees a dog that was aggressive or was troublesome, and then they see it again and go, oh my gosh, what happened? You have a whole new dog. And then they say, well, that was the Pooch Coach. And then people are like, heck yeah.
Okay, Pooch Coach, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Beverly Ulbricht, the person whose website is poochcoach.com. What's your question or comment for her? Hi, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi, I was just wondering about a dog who's about a year and a half who seems to be pretty territorial in terms of guarding the house, but once somebody, she knows somebody or somebody's in, she is the sweetest dog ever. And kind of, is it realistic to think that's something that we can change about the dog? And if so, how to go about it?
Good question.
Yeah. First of all, how to go about it is to work with a behaviorist, because it's not a quick, easy solution. But I will tell you that that's a very common problem. And by definition, you almost answered your own question. Since your dog can warm up and learn to love people, you know she can. It's just the way to do it and how to get it to happen faster.
So how do, well, what, walk me, let's paint a picture. If she hired you as a behaviorist, and this dog is territorial, that is, barks his or her head off when anytime anybody comes within 50 feet of the door or the house or whatever, what do you do?
Well, first I want to meet the dog and ascertain the level of the threat and also find out if the dog has actually bitten or not, because it obviously depends. If a dog has bit several people, that's completely different than a dog that only has barked and had opportunity to bite but has not. So I find out how severe the situation is. If it's a mild situation, it's pretty simple. Actually, all I do is say, you go back to giving your dog only kibble and low-end cookies, and you get $100 treats, I call them, that are the best treats your dog will love. Not hot dogs and crap like that, dog treats that are good for dogs. and then you take them and have the strangers just give those to your dog. Mm. If every single time your dog sees a stranger,
whoa,
they get a $100 treat, it's Pavlovian training, right? It's like bell food, it's stranger treat, and after a while, the dog goes up. Like my dog runs up to little kids and smells their hands because she assumes they have cookies. You make that pairing for your dog and it makes it very simple, along with obviously training them and telling them what you want them to do and other things along those lines too.
What about if it's a biter? Obviously, if it's biting all the time, it may be the time to take the dog back to the pound or something. Is that right? If the dog is biting strangers routinely, what's the right thing to do?
To get it assessed, because again, I will assess whether that's its owner error or a dog problem. There are dogs that are crazy. There are dogs I have to suggest that, you know, their own brain is triggering wrong. They're randomly biting for no reason. There's no way we can make heads or tails out of this. There's something wrong with them. That happens maybe twice a year.
Oh, I see.
But all the other dogs, it's a trigger and response, and I can work on it with them as long as people will work. The issue becomes, to be honest, that people get too scared. They're so nervous about their own dog that the dog picks up on their energy, and then the dog gets even more nervous, and so it becomes this really vicious cycle as the dog gets more nervous and the person gets more nervous and on and on.
Dear caller, is, you know, where on that continuum is your doggy? Is it a routine regular biter? Are you just a barker or an occasional biter? What's the deal?
She will growl, and you know, I mean, she's a cute looking dog, but she'll growl and people get intimidated. She's big enough. And then in terms of biting, she has bit another dog, which seemed a little bit more than she wasn't playing. When the dog, you know, we kind of brought the dog into the house and didn't introduce in the way we should have. But still, you know, it was a scary thing for us to actually see her do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so the other thing we talk about is how to better do introductions in the future, like meeting at a dog park and walking together on leash and getting them into like a kind of pack happy mentality of walking together before you bring them back to your house. There's things like that that you can do to offset the invasion, you know, feeling that your dog's getting of having their den invaded.
Thank you very much for the call. Let's go right back to the phone. Let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, Beverly Ulbricht. She runs Pooch.net. She does. She is the dog trainer, animal behaviorist at PoochCoach.com. What is your question or comment for Beverly?
Hi, yes. I was wondering what advice you would have for a recent college grad in animal science who's passionate about etiology and attempting to kind of settle in the right path, but overwhelmed by the animal behavior world and kind of how to break into the industry.
Good question. Is there a niche or something? What advice, if she were your daughter or sister, what advice would you give her about trying to break into this crowded world of animal behaviorists, dog trainers, and sitters and walkers?
Yeah, I mean, what some people do is they do start out as something else, like a vet tech or a walker, and then work their way into a training. You can also work for a trainer and do kind of, you know, like, getting mentored from them. I've mentored some people in the past when I had more time. So you can learn underneath their wing as well. And it's obviously easier if you're part of a larger company, because then you'll get work thrown to you and you don't have to do your own marketing. Because again, your own marketing is going to be the biggest challenge for most people. So if you can get, if somebody else is handing you the people and the jobs, then it gets easier.
Is there a niche that makes so it's not such a struggle, because there are so many dog trainers out there, other than a service dog trainer, which everybody knows about, hearing dogs and for the visually impaired and diabetic dogs and seizure dogs. And what niches would you, if she were your sister, what would you encourage her to be, a generalist or focus on a niche?
I, to be honest with this kind of stuff, I think you have to follow your passion. That's where I go back to. It's just what you are good at. Like, I can't say, like, for instance, aggression is probably the best for to make money in, but it's also the hardest, the most dangerous. I've had pit bulls right in my face that could have killed me, you know, and some people can't handle that pressure, don't want to take that risk, don't have the personality and the wherewithal to handle that kind of pressure on their job. Some people just want to, you know, play with puppies, so then they should just be a puppy trainer. You got to do what feels good to you, too.
Dear caller, I'm a little more, when I hear the word follow your passion, I get a little nervous, because too many people have the same passion and therefore they're struggling. I am more of a fan of finding a little under the radar niche, like training, you know, dogs for people who are epileptic. You know, dogs can sense when their person's about to have a seizure or hearing impaired. Or is there some specialty that is the intersection of what you're curious about and that maybe isn't so obvious? Are you there?
Yes. Sorry. Yes. So I actually currently work as a equine vet tech, and I work at a smaller company. So I actually really understand and respect your views as far as working in a larger company and the marketing aspect of it. And I've struggled. I've worked in exotics and small and large animal, and looked at. It seems that grad programs and etiology kind of surround what we eat. You know, that's where the research money is, and much else as far as getting into vet school and being in debt my whole career. It seems overwhelming, and the options just, I don't know how anyone makes it.
You can't. What I'm hearing is this. Here's what's...
I've tried a different variety of things, so I love this advice and feedback. And if there's anything else based on the information I just shared with you, I would love... any advice you have?
The niche, what's coming out at me is when you say you have experience with exotics. Exotics are some of them, you know, when we're talking about exotics, could be anything from a boa constrictor to a turtle to, in the movies, they use animals all the time. And I'm wondering whether you should specialize in the training of exotics, perhaps even for movies, commercials, whatever. Might that be an unusual niche that nonetheless is something that leverages your experience?
It's very interesting. I was fortunate enough to have an internship where I worked at a zoo down in Sheenness. It was actually a wildlife sanctuary at that point, and that's kind of how he started, was in the animal industry, and transformed it into this beautiful zoo. And it seems that path of his was beautiful and passionate. And I,
have I lost you? I think we're going to have to take... Yeah, I'm. You're going in and out, so I'm going to have to thank you for the call. For what it's worth, I mean, that's generally the truth. It's finding that intersection between a passion, but what might be viable in the marketplace is normally the sweet spot as far as I'm concerned. Now, Beverly, we were talking, I mentioned briefly to her about the movies and ads and commercials, and you've had some experience with that. What do you want to tell us about your experience in that space?
That's actually the most fun for me. Like, if I could do something all the time, it'd probably be that aspect of my job of just being able to provide the animals for TV and movies, especially my own animals. I love trying to figure out how to make a dog look like they're doing something on the screen and figuring out how to do that, puzzling it out and making it happen. It's really fun. Of course, that also has its issues, though, too, including being in the Bay Area. In the Bay Area, I'm the go-to person, but it's saturated down in LA, obviously. And it's also few and far between, so it's hard to make a full-time job. And a lot of stuff is independent work, so they don't even have a big budget. Even some of the ads don't have a huge budget for this stuff.
So, you know, given what you're saying, that even in this, you know, kind of niche-y stuff, whether you're being a generalist or you're going to niche in the movies or whatever, you're spending a lot of time marketing, and even there it's not so easy. So if I were your brother, would you honestly encourage me to go into dog training at this point? At this point in time?
The only way I would is if I saw that you had some amazing skill in it that I thought had to be used. Like, wow, you're so good at this, you should do it. As opposed to, like, if I thought, you're struggling a little, you have a lot to learn, it's going to be an uphill climb, you must be better at something else.
What kind of unique special gift would those be?
You can just tell somebody when they're working with dogs well. I'm sure you see it too. There's dog people and there aren't. There are people that know how to pet a dog. There's people that don't know how to interact with a dog at all. You start there. But certainly, there's people that I can watch a couple that both own the same dog. One of them tells the dog to sit. The dog sits immediately. The other one says it six times, follows the dogs around. As the dog ignores them, they get all frustrated. This happened just last night in my house. I watched this one guy get like almost to tears because his dog just would not listen to him. And the other person completely listened to him. So some people just have more innate ability. And that's really what we have to tap into. There's such a communication level that's different between animals and humans that you kind of have to already have it. You can't learn that, I think.
You know, my board operator, Joanne Marr, just sent me a question. According to the renowned TV star Cesar Millan, the dog whisperer, your dog needs, quote, strong pack leadership from you, the true alpha dog, in order to be healthy and balanced. It's called dominance theory. But let's say a dog has problems, barks too much. Are there limits to asserting dominance over a dog? What about, for example, subduing dogs with shock collars or by pinning them to the ground or tightening their collars? What do you think about that?
All of it is very, very dangerous to do anything that's painful to your dog.
I agree.
What I talk to people, I have to fix dogs all the time that have been put through that kind of training, that have had shock collars and that kind of stuff. And to be honest, there's a time and a place sometimes when it could actually almost like be useful for certain things, like really far off leash work or something. But you should never, ever think of a shock collar to stop your dog from barking or to the quick example of why it's so silly. If your dog is barking at, let's say, people or other dogs, they're doing it because they're scared. The hidden thing behind everything is, I'm scared, I'm uncomfortable, I'm going to voice it with aggression by barking. If you then start shocking them, how on earth is that going to help them? All it's going to do is make them hate and fear the person or dog even more. Again, that's what I get handed a lot of these dogs that already didn't like it, and now they've been shocked on top of it, and they're like so confused, and they're so scared, and they lost trust of their master too. Their owner is like, why are you doing this to me?
Absolutely. It makes so much sense to me. On the other end of kind of the continuum, I see a lot of people. I go around the Lafayette Reservoir every day with my dog, and I see a lot of people with clickers. Tell me, what is clicker training, and is it good, bad? What's the deal with clickers?
I think you just saw me roll my eyes.
Yeah, I did.
I love the theory behind clicker training. Karen Pryor is great. Her book, I recommend her book highly. It's called Don't Shoot the Dog. Excellent, excellent book on just learning theory. It teaches you how to get your boyfriend to do what you want as much as anything else. I mean, it's about, that's what learning theory is, and being able to shape behavior. Clicker training in itself, though, is how it was invented to train dolphins, and it's great for training dolphins because you can't yell under the water, sit down. You know, you have to get something where you blow the whistle, pair it with a food, and then work through it with dolphins. You don't have to do that with dogs. They're right here. I can just tell them sit and lure them into position. So why would I use a quick clicker? My clicker in my program is the words good dog. That's all you need. My dog knows if I say good dog, she did the right thing. I don't have to have something else that makes a noise.
Mine is good doggy. You're the best Einstein.
Exactly.
And so now you've been doing it a long time, and you're still, you know, it's got to get old after a while, and the regular kind of work and the marketing and all the rest of it. What's really next for Beverly?
I'm hoping this new dog I have, she's still a puppy, she's amazing, and I really, really think she might be able to do something good for me finally, to get a TV show or a movie. Like, that's going to be really, she's just so good that I'm hoping she's going to be the breakthrough dog for me, and I could go do that for a while. But otherwise, it's always new. Each story is so different. The dog's different. The relationship with their human is different. So it really does keep me going. I mean, I get bored of the same pitch I have to give sometimes, but again, it's all so unique with each individual energy and of the person I'm working with. So as long as I keep getting, you know, nice and willful people to work with, it's great. It's just when you get the bad egg, sometimes it gets a little harder too.
Well, you haven't been a bad egg. It's been good to have you on my show.
Thanks.
Beverly Obrick, thanks for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco. Again, her website is poochcoach.com. Thanks again.
Thanks again for having me.
I know you said you got to duck out, so feel free.
Yep, no, thanks.
No problem. Anyway, okay, so now, my dear listeners, we turn to you. If you have a work-related problem, a core purpose of this show is to help you with your work struggle. whether you are self-employed, thinking about it, or you're working for a company, a government, nonprofit, whether you're starting out or nearer the end of your career. The only thing that's required is you've got a work problem that you'd like some free advice on. This is what I've been doing now for 29 and a half years here at KELW. The phone number for what I call a workover, with no pummeling involved, usually. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. A number of my clients have asked, or wondering at least, whether it's wise to be a generalist or a specialist. And I wanted to share some thoughts about that. Many people enjoy dabbling, and that's understandable. You know, because that first thrust of learning about a topic is filled with novelty. It's important novelty. But that quickly, usually, reaches a point of diminishing returns. There's less important new material. There's more redundancy. So it's tempting to dabble in something new, something else, until that's not so much fun. But specializing is often crucial to a career. Even if you're aspiring to leadership, in which you generally need to be somewhat of a generalist, getting in the door for a job that's a launch pad to a higher level position or leadership usually requires expertise that's well beyond dabbling. And of course, there's exceptions. I mean, especially like if your parent runs the company, or you're sleeping with an employer, or you're of a much sought after demographic. But in general, it's likely, at least, that employers who are offering at least a middle-class paying job are going to yawn at a dabbler. Let's take an example, for example, of, say, two identical twins who are, say, psychology majors. And both of them aspire, say, to be leaders, you know, directors, vice presidents, CEO-type people. But only one of them is focused. And so she, in her taking her course, say, on personality, in the psychology major, when she's doing the required reading for the course, she paid particular attention to the role of personality in the workplace. And she wrote her term paper on that. And then when it came time for elective, she took an elective course in principles of management. And not only did she get an internship in a human resource department, she made sure she got to observe and even participate in discussions of disputes between bosses and supervisees. Now, obviously, that latter twin is more hireable for a job that's a launch pad to her career goal of leadership. And not only is a person like that more hireable, he or she is less subject to that disease that is rampant among even new holders of doctorates, that is the imposter syndrome. If you develop a practical specialization, that's an antidote. Now, of course, the person would still be a newbie, but with reasonable and consistent effort, you know, maybe improved skill in running meetings, giving talks, project management, that person would be ahead of the pack when it comes time for promotion. And if at a particular workplace he or she is stalled, the person can now is able to make a good case to other employers for why he or she is ready for advancement. And all this, by the way, I've been using kind of a soft skill example, but it's also true in technical fields. Rather than just say majoring in computer science, focus on a niche within computer science that's in demand and likely to stay so, like genomics, like the big data analysis in the genomic space, or machine learning, deep learning, artificial intelligence, though that whole space, and especially in a particular domain. You know, even these days we're in such hyper-specialization, especially in technology, that even specializing in artificial intelligence is too broad. You know, artificial intelligence in the consumer space, in the cybersecurity space, is normally the level of specificity and specialization that is can make you very, very desirable. And again, once you're in that launchpad job, focus not just on staying current in your specialization, but that's the time to acquire the soft skills that you need to rise to you know, management and leadership. So I need to say that most people, or many people at least, are happy with a role as an individual contributor. At least they're going to accept that in exchange for the pleasure of being a generalist and avoiding the deep dive of specialization. But if you aspire to a leadership role, not just, for example, in computers, just being a coder, but looking for a leadership role, it's often wise to specialize. That can help you get in the door of a desired field and a desired place of employment. And once you're in, you know, in that place of employment, then, yeah, take the time to stay current in your specialization. But in order to rise in these ever-ratcheted-up requirements for good jobs, you're going to then have the time, and you want to make the time, to develop the soft skills needed to become an excellent leader. And those are my thoughts about being a generalist versus a specialist. I'd like to give out the phone number. If you have a work-related problem, I'm happy to help you. All you need to do is call Work with Marty Nemco and KALW. The phone number here is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Kind of, you know, implicit in what I was just talking about is this whole notion about learning, getting more skilled at X, Y, or Z. I took on a challenge for myself, which was to kind of create a mini little lecture in 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, something like that, on how to get good at nearly anything. Now, of course, it's going to have to be adapted to a particular situation, but, you know, great. So you say, I want to become a specialist in X, or I want to improve my public speaking skills or whatever. How do you do it? There are some people who are really good at being good at nearly everything. Now, yeah, to be really honest, sure, they probably do have a high IQ, which means they quickly learn, they quickly retain, and they have that ability to apply their knowledge to solve a wide range of problems. But to be really honest again, IQ, intelligence, reasoning skills, cognitive skills, whatever you want to call it, it's relatively immutable. And pop psych concepts such as grit and growth mindset, they feel good, but they have been found to have far less utility than their conceptualizers have claimed. And I always like when I make contraintuitive statements, I want you to know that I'm not just shooting from the hip. So if any of you would like to see the research that has been debunking these very popular terms like grit and growth mindset, email me and I will send you the links. My email address is mnemco, that's M, is the first initial of my first name for Marty, mnemco, my last name, N-E-M-K-O, at comcast.net. Anyway, but what I want to propose to you is a more likely approach to getting good at most things than trying to just rely on grit or growth mindset to try to increase your IQ, which is pretty immutable. Here's a 4-step plan for tackling tasks, which I've derived these from my many quite successful clients and friends, and okay, from my own life as well. So I'm going to present this plan with an example. It's a person whose career and personal life's being ruined by anxiety and how they're trying to get good at dealing with that. So step one is to do what I call a time-effective Google search. I've said this before, but it's so important it's worth mentioning again. We take Google search for granted because it's free and it's instant and it's ubiquitous. But it curates from billions of articles and videos and whatever. It's and up to date. It's amazing. So start by Google searching the term anxiety, or if your anxiety is in a specific context, let's say social anxiety or test anxiety, search on those terms while putting the term social anxiety in quotes so that Google looks for it as a phrase, social anxiety, rather than separately the word social and separately the word anxiety. Then scan just the top few results because Google does a great job of curating the results. So those top few are really generally worth your considering, at least. You don't have to open those files yet or go to those websites, but just scan the little report in the Google search result. Search both for articles and usually videos. And then you click on any of those top few search results that feel like they're worth a look. And you start not by reading. People tend to read at one speed. Start by skimming. That's a way to be time effective. If that skimming is feeling like, oh, this is a valuable article, keep going, maybe skim more, and maybe read more slowly. And if it's not very helpful, cut your losses. Remember, there's so many sources. Google gives you so many different sources. You can have high standards and not run out of good articles. Really, many people do fail to get the most from their Google searching time by spending too much time with what I call suboptimal articles and videos, right? You needn't just settle for just okay. Learn what you can from glancing at your first search results and maybe one, two, or three of its top articles or videos, top-ranked ones. And if you need more or better information, that glancing may also, before you even open any of those websites, will often yield a more on-target search term, which is a great way to do a better, you know, a follow-up Google search. Or you'll see the author of an article, who's the one article you read and the author seems really expert, search on that person's name. So maybe it's social anxiety and, you know, Harry Michaels. And now you probably will get something more. Now, I understand that many people are, you know, that this would make them nervous because they tend to be ducks in a row type. And they resist relying on just a few articles. Of course, sometimes deeper knowledge is required, but I have been struck how often, even regarding complicated topics, we reach a point of diminishing returns after just a bit of reading. Anyway, I want to go to the phones, but I'll give out the phone number again. If you have a work-related problem, I do what I call workovers here at KELW, and the show is Work with Marty Nemko. I invite you to call. Love to help you out. The phone number here is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, Marty. I've got a question about transitioning from a sales role into something different. I've mm-hmm. been a sales rep for about 20 years, and I work in an industry that I enjoy, but I'm thinking about expanding from there and considered getting into supply chain. I know there's a lot of online MBAs for supply chain management, and I just wondered if you thought that was a good approach to growing out of this career at age 46.
Oh, what? Well, you know, tell me your industry. What industry? You said you enjoy your industry. Tell me the industry.
It's craft beer industry.
Okay, great. So the supply chain in, you know, sales is about negotiation. It is about making a persuasive case, closing the deal. And indeed, sales skills would seem very important in the supply chain. For example, we all know that every beer manufacturer needs to get hops, needs to get the spice mixes. There are various spice. One has got a very funny romantic name, something like Bits of Heaven, Taste of Heaven, or something like that. And there's a lot of different things, labels and equipment and machines. So in each time when you are trying to make a buy, and this is no longer purchasing, supply chain is more complicated than that, but I would think that your sales skills could be leveraged because you're basically trying to sell a supplier to give you this quality, a set of spices for this craft beer at a good price, yep, at a right delivery time, right terms, etc. And it would be smarter if you're trying to make a change into a different field that you stay within your industry, especially since you like it. So is there, and I would not run, I am not somebody who's so quick to invest the huge time and money in a master's program, even if 90% of the people who are in the field have that master's. Because at 46, you're going to apply now, you'll get in at 47, you're going to be doing it for 2 years, 49, and you're either going to be making no income or going to be exhausted and doing it at night. I would rather see you try to leverage your existing sales expertise and knowledge of the vertical market of craft beer to try to get a job in supply chain now. Does that make sense?
It does, yes.
Anyway, that's my best advice. I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty.
Yep. Sometimes it's very quick, sometimes it's not. I tend to be, I may be fast talking, but I'm patient. So I'll give you with the time you need, basically, within limits. So if you've got a work-related problem, I'll try to help you solve it. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before I went to the phones, I was talking about a four-step approach to getting good at nearly everything. And I started by talking about a time-effective Google search. And now I want to talk about step two, and that is to do what I call a low-risk experiment. Let's say your Googling identifies a variety of approaches to dealing with anxiety. I'm using anxiety as an example, somebody who's trying to deal more effectively with anxiety. Unless you're confident that those approaches aren't going to work, and so there's no need, for example, to jump to, for example, say, taking an SSRI drug like Prozac, you might try one or more of the low-risk actions that you unearthed from your reading or watching videos. Maybe it's increased exercise, or what's called thought stopping. That is, every time one of those worrisome thoughts, you simply stop and redirect yourself. Or journaling has often been very helpful. Or there's great apps now, an app I really like. I just wrote about it in Psychology Today, called Pacifica, which is, you know, a wide range of tools for dealing with anxiety. Or simply talking with a trusted friend and a good listener. These are low-risk activities. And so what you do is you're doing it as an experiment, a low-risk experiment. You try it for a while, and you continue with the ones that are helpful, and you dump the others. Step three, you break down the issue in baby steps, the method that you're trying to use. So let's say you're trying to practice thought stopping, that business about, you know, when a worrisome thought comes to mind, you simply say stop. So the baby steps might be, number one, to write one or more situations that tend to make you anxious. Two, come up with what will be calming to you in those situations. Let's say you get anxious when you get a pain of ambiguous origin. You might write, my doctor says that as long as it's not scary painful, most pains go away within a day or three. There's little risk in waiting, so I need to make myself redirect to something productive. So you would write that. And then, because that's too long to keep in mind, you can reduce that spiel to a mantra like, not dangerous, distract. Okay? So that breaking down to baby steps, once you've found a method that's at least worth a try, is a great approach. And the final step in the fourth steps of getting good at nearly anything is know when it is time-effective and cost-effective to outsource. If those low-risk experiments are failing and you sense that they're going to continue to be inadequate, it's time to give up or to consult someone. Yeah, it could be a friend or a family member, but maybe a professional. And, of course, that's true whether it's a career issue, a mental or physical health issue, or, for that matter, even a home repair issue. So you got to, in deciding whether to do that, whether to outsource, consider your track record. For example, I have a terrible record of trying to fix anything beyond the very basic around the house. So faster than most people would, I often decide it's worth calling in the electrician, the plumber, whatever. Okay, so I want to go over the four steps briefly again. These four steps are usually a smart way to get good at nearly anything at minimal cost and minimal time. Number one, a time-effective Google search. Two, try a low-risk experiment with a way to improve that you have learned. Three, break that experiment into baby steps. Four, and then know when it's time and cost-effective to outsource. And of course, look, no goal as broad as getting good at nearly anything can be reduced to a four-step plan. But there's little risk in trying it. After all, it's an example of one of those the tips I mentioned. It's a low-risk experiment. But it is one that's been helpful to many people, many of my clients. I also do need to mention the value of self-study plus tutor. If there's something you want to learn, you know, that's more complicated than what an article or two can do, get the top-rated textbook that you find or book on it that you find on Amazon, self-study, and then put a little post-it in the margins every time you run into a question, and then find somebody to tutor you, which you can often get, you know, through a standard tutoring site like Wyzant, W-Y-Z-A-N-T, or maybe it's somebody at your workplace who you know is good at that thing you're trying to learn, or simply Google the thing you're trying to learn. Let's say you're trying to learn Python, Python coaching, Python tutoring, or find somebody who wrote an article on Introduction to Python. And that is another way to avoid the long, complicated degree programs or even certificate programs. Anyway, and one more thing I guess I want to say. Sometimes you do feel, you know, some people need the structure of a course. I have grown to be a huge fan of two sources of learning outside the traditional university. One is the Extension course, UC Berkeley Extension, San Francisco State Extension, that kind of thing. They offer practical courses in there. Because they're tuition-driven, they really only keep professors who do a good job teaching. And the other is the incredible proliferation of good online courses that are low and cheap, which are curated beautifully in LinkedIn Learning, in edX, and in Coursera. Those are platforms. So that's perhaps the world's shortest course at getting good at anything, or nearly anything. So if you've got a work-related problem and you would like my help, the phone number here for what I call a workover, 415-841-4145. 4134. What's that, the number four? It's the number four of the show, Work with Marty Nemco here at KALW. This is what I do during the week for a living, but here it is my pro bono work, and I do it for free. So the phone number, if you'd like a workover, 415-841-4134. Now, I've been focusing here on getting more capable, getting smarter, whether you should be a generalist or not. But unfortunately, we live in a world and in which perception can matter almost as much as the reality. And so it matters to seem smarter. Even if you've gotten really competent, it's important to seem smarter. So a couple weeks ago, I talked a little bit about this, and I gave some tips, like it's critical that you're doing work that uses your recently acquired, well-acquired knowledge. It's important to take on supervisory and mentoring roles, so you don't have to have the deep knowledge, but you're there more as a glue, as a facilitator. I also talked about the importance of avoiding taking all or nothing positions. So often, a sign of not seeming smart is black and white thinking, and that can occur from the political left or the political right, and it can occur in apolitical areas in the workplace. Also, language. It's really embarrassing when I see people using $10 words and they're using them wrong. It's good to have a good vocabulary, but there is a great website called vocabulary.com that will help it boost your vocabulary. They have little games and things which work very well. Other ways to appear intelligent is to ask curiosity-driven questions. In other words, really listen to what's being said, and that can trigger questions you're curious to ask about. So you may not actually be smarter, but by asking questions, you appear smarter. And another example is what I call tell your tried and trues. Over your lifetime, you may have some well-honed anecdotes or arguments, or you can riff on a different given topic. You know, list your favorites in advance and consult that list before you're attending a social gathering. So at the right moment, you can trot one out. And that needn't be limited to conversation. You could give talks, for example, at a professional conference or at a meeting of a hobbyist organization. By doing this in advance, listing your tried and trues, you'll have plenty of time to assemble and organize those smart thoughts, and you can just put them on a note card to have them with you. Those are ways to seem smarter without being smarter. But unfortunately, we are, in addition to these at least semi-substantive ways to seem smarter, there are really shallower ways, and I would be a little bit remiss if I was not sharing with you the fact that some of these really silly ways to seem smarter are effective. We are a visual species, so how you come across can make a stronger impression even than what you say. For example, think about the celebrities we admire, from the elected officials to the TV anchors. Disproportionately, they are what I would call conventionally attractive, and they have a moderate demeanor, moderately energetic, yet they're calm. They're confident, yet they're not hubristic. They stand erect, but their posture is relaxed. They dress well, but in the mainstream, lest it appear they're trying to stand out with their veneer rather than their substance. I mean, like I said, it's really sad that to be viewed as credible intelligence so depends on treading that middle ground, but I'm trying to deal here with you as in dealing with humankind as it is, not attempting the Herculean task of changing humankind's predispositions or predilections. There is, though, a little-known but powerful component of a person's demeanor that conveys intelligence as well as charisma and likability. It's often warned that interrupting a person in a conversation is rude, and it signals that you think that what you have to say is so much worthier than of the person's time than the person you would, so you chose to cut them off. That warning is correct, but it has an under-discussed corollary. It's wise to wait a half second, maybe even a full second, before responding when a person finishes their utterance. If you do that, it implies you want to be sure that the person's finished, that you were eager to hear all that they were saying and not just waiting for them to shut up before you launched into your more important words. A full second pause signals additionally that you're reflecting on what they were saying. Now, I got to admit, I'm terrible at this. I can't seem to help interrupting. And I rationalize that sometimes clients think it's smart and it's fast-paced and exciting. But deep down, because I watch C-SPAN all the time, and the most influential people rarely interrupt. Those who interrupt are seen as hotheads and rude. So it's a way, again, to seem smarter without actually being smarter. I'll give out the phone number one last time. We have time for one call. If you if you're a procrastinator and you have a question you'd like to ask me about your work life, phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Rather than ending the show on just, you know, ways to seem smarter, I want to offer another couple little tips to actually get smarter. I think maybe the most potent, that's realistic, is to try to spend more time with people who are moderately smarter than you. The more time you spend around people who are just one notch smarter than you, not four notches, because then they're just too over your head. I mean, if I was spending most of my time with, you know, Nobel Prize winners in astrophysics, I'm not going to gain that much. But if I'm dealing with a career counselor who's one notch better than me, I'm going to perhaps grow. And hopefully their intellectual skills as well as their knowledge is going to rub off. It's kind of analogous to playing a sport. If you're playing with people who are moderately better than you, you're observing skills that are somewhat beyond you but still within reach. Also, you're spending much of your time playing to stretch yourself to compete, yet you're not playing against someone so superior that their play is beyond you, even if you gave it your best efforts, in which case you'll probably just give up. So bringing it to the workplace here, if within your workplace, see if you can do projects with people who are one notch brighter. And if you're looking for a new workplace, it's often worth taking a lower-level job at an organization known for hiring bright people. Like, for example, it might be worth being an HR assistant at Google than an HR manager at the Ace Widget Company. And outside of work, also consider spending lots of time, platonically and romantically, with people who are one notch above. And likely as important as who you interact with is what you do with them. At work, if you're just licking envelopes for some bright person, you're going to grow little. But even if it's just taking notes for a group of smart people, doing that gets you a window into the way those smart people think. Of course, better still is to get to engage with them on a thinking part of a project, like brainstorming, winnowing ideas, developing the plan, troubleshooting it. I mean, in our ever more knowledge and thinking-centric society, appearing intelligent and being intelligent is actually pretty darn central to getting and staying well-employed and in having sustainable personal relationships that are rewarding. I hope that one or more of these suggestions that I've been offering about seeming smarter as well as being smarter should be helpful, not just in how you're perceived, but hopefully also in substance, because that often is key. People are often wondering, why am I always seeming on the layoff list? Geez, it seems like such bad luck. Too often employers are not candid. You know, it's easy to point out if your attendance was bad or you have a bad attitude. You can say you blew up at somebody or whatever. But, you know, it's not politically correct to say you're not intelligent enough. Your reasoning skills aren't good enough. So hopefully these tips that I've offered are things that will help you to stay well-employed and make a bigger contribution to your workplace. In any case, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7 p.m. You can call in for a workover. Plus, I'll talk with Jeff Herman. He is a literary agent who has sold more than 1,000 books to publishers. I'm going to ask him, though, for some straight talk about getting published in 2019 and beyond. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't. We'll be right back.